is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program is home-crafted and was recorded on May 14th. On May 1st, Labor Day for most of the world, The Nation published an image essay by Molly Crabapple titled The Faces of Our Crisis. She writes that she's tired of reading about lessons learned from the pandemic, specifically articles authored by financially secure people who work from home and have more time to bake. Crabapple wonders about the newly immiserated members of the middle class who saw their entire means of making a living disappear. And why does it never include those essential workers whose scorned labor turns the earth? An illustrator by trade, she considers herself as one of the lucky ones who has always worked from home. The essay includes images that she drew of workers who sent in their selfies. They are sanitation workers and nurses. They stock the shelves at grocery stores, dispatch 911 calls, and pick crops. Without them, the bored, confined, financially well-off would rapidly starve to death. Crabapple observes that there are several lessons to be learned during this time, but notes that an important one is that the people who grow the food and lug the boxes and tend the sick have the power to make the world stand still. As the wildcat strikes across the country show, they are using this power to demand their due for all that they have created. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Gus Bova. Gus is a staff writer for the Texas Observer. Welcome, Gus. How are you doing with the lockdown here and stay at home?
Relatively fortunate in the scheme of things. I still have a steady paycheck and I haven't gotten sick myself, but I imagine, like a lot of people, I'm just really starting to feel that this is dragging on. It's starting to feel like sort of a permanent change more than a temporary crisis, you know?
Yeah, I definitely hear you. How long you been with the Texas Observer now?
So if you go back to when I was an intern, it's about 4 years now.
Okay. And you've been primarily reporting on, been doing a lot on border issues. I think the last time we had you on, we were talking about the border, but more recently, you've been doing some stuff with homeless and some other issues. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I've sort of jumped around from quite a bit on immigration and the border, and I've touched on this issue throughout my time at The Observer. I've been doing labor reporting, and homelessness I kind of picked up basically last year when it was sort of the major news story in Austin as the governor was sort of launching a social media campaign against Austin's homeless. We didn't have anyone on staff to pick that issue up, so I picked it up.
Great. So more recently, I've noticed that you've written a number of pieces about labor. I've picked up during the pandemic, there's been a lot of focus on frontline workers. You know, we think people in supermarkets, for example. I'm at least a little bit heartened that in Texas, people are actually talking about labor organizing. I mean, who'd have guessed?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. There are sort of signs of life across the country and in Texas, which of course has incredibly low union density. And that's one of the interesting things about sort of the trend of labor activism during this pandemic is a lot of it is taking place in non-unionized workspaces. You know, there's a lot of sort of impromptu organizing going on, organizing among gig workers, organizing sort of, you might call them wildcat strikes. I mean, these are, in Texas, for instance, if you want to look at grocery workers, the only unionized grocery store is the Kroger chain in Houston and Dallas. So other workers have had to just find other ways to express themselves. One thing, there's a lot more online petitions and online campaigns have been cropping up. This coworker.org site has seen a huge spike in campaigns. There was a campaign on there for HEB to do hazard pay. There's a campaign on there about a Sprouts store down near the border in McAllen. So anywho, it's an interesting upswing. But the big question is whether any of it will last, you know?
Yeah, I noticed your one article, you wrote quite a bit about that Sprouts store in McAllen. Could you tell us a little about those folks?
Yeah, that was an interesting story. I mean, I got to talk to a really insightful and compelling young man down there, Josh Cano, who's a college student, but also works full time at the Sprouts store down in McAllen. And as listeners probably know, Sprouts is a sort of health food, sort of hippie grocery store. And
basically, he and his coworkers, well into March, were working without basic personal protective equipment, without limits on the number of customers in the store, without hazard pay or anything like that, basically operating business as usual. And what he did was he actually was just, he's a young guy and he was just online on social media and he came across a flyer that was put out by this sort of ad hoc organization that's formed during this time. It's a collaboration between an electrical workers union and the Democratic Socialists of America, actually, just kind of a thing thrown together during the time of the pandemic to try to connect non-union workers with some folks with organizing experience, basically. He connected with this experienced organizer through that work. They got a petition going online. The petition was really successful. Thousands and thousands of signatures. Bernie Sanders tweeted it. And Sprouts wouldn't talk to me for the story, so I can't say what their reasoning was. But shortly after that took off, they did go ahead and start providing more protective equipment and also start limiting the number of customers in the store. They have not done a hazard pay bonus or a hero pay bonus, what have you. But it was an interesting example of a little surge of labor activism carried out by folks who had no experience doing this before, who won something material. But again, it's just very temporary, right? These are pandemic specific concerns. And who knows what the long term benefits might be.
So you mentioned this hazard or hero pay. So I guess HEB is doing that. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. HEB has a $2 an hour raise, as does Kroger, as does Whole Foods. That's probably not the entire list, but those three come to mind. Mm-hmm. And basically, they all implemented this $2 hero pay or hazard pay sometime in March, and they've sort of been extending it in little 2 week or so increments. Right now, Whole Foods is set to get rid of theirs on June 1st, and Kroger in just a few days, May 17th, I believe, and I think HEB is May 24th. So all of the end dates are coming up. Mm-hmm. And basically, I think the key thing to remember is that this is a $2 raise for people who in many cases are making maybe $10, $11 an hour, right? Even with the $2 raise, they're making well below a living wage in a city like Austin or Houston or Dallas.
Right.
And taking that away, especially after they put themselves and their families at risk, for many workers are upset at that prospect. Basically, we'll see what happens.
Backing up just a little, you mentioned that Kroger is really the only unionized supermarket in the state. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Wow. And their stores are in Dallas and Houston. And, you know, it's funny, you really realize the difference. This is just my sort of observation in some of the reporting I've done recently. Kroger wages are not in another realm from HEB wages or other grocery store wages. They're roughly similar, but there's these other benefits to a union. Having basically a spokesperson, their union, the UFCW, was pushing for recognition from the state of grocery workers as essential employees so that they could get subsidized childcare. And they've been trying to work on getting priority access to testing, which they've been successful at in Dallas County. So not only is it a lobby, but it gives you a point of contact. You see, if you want to know, if you want to get a sense, for instance, of how many grocery workers have died from COVID-19 across the nation, your only real place to go is the union. They're keeping their own informal list. They're the best source of information on this. And once the workers are in there, they're just, like, I was able to talk to a Kroger cashier in Dallas who was able to just be completely frank with me, give me all of her opinions on the record and not really be afraid in a way that I think most the HEB employees I talked to, for instance, I'm not saying anything specific about HEB exactly, but you know, they were nervous and wanted to be off the record, for example. There's a certain loss of fear that comes with the union, is my observation from this reporting.
Interesting. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we've got actually have anti-union efforts going on. Did I read Trader Joe's and Whole Foods? Is that your take?
Yeah, exactly. Amazon, Whole Foods, Trader Joe's. Basically, despite the pandemic, the big stores that have ongoing unionization drives have continued to sort of use pay for anti-union consulting work to send letters. The Trader Joe's letter is worth a read. It basically says that the union is a distraction in this crucial time of the pandemic. The tone from Trader Joe's is sort of almost trying to shame the workers for considering organizing during this time. And basically, there seems to be pretty little fear of on the part of these big companies as far as continuing to oppose unionization during the pandemic. So that and a couple other reasons, you know, call into question whether any of these temporary gains will be able to be made permanent, honestly.
Well, again, it's interesting that we're even talking about labor organizing in Texas. I mean, this is heartening. You know, you mentioned HEB, and they got a fair amount of good press for having been prepared for all this. Although I noticed a few days ago, there was some lawsuit against them for price gouging during all this. Have you heard anything about that? Or
no, I missed that. Was that from the AG? Was that from Paxson, or was that from?
No, I think it was a private lawsuit.
I'll have to look into that. But I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I'm not suggesting that the praise for their preparedness was undeserved, right? But it was certainly, there was a lot of press coverage that was really coming from the perspective of the higher ups at HEB, and it was very flattering and, again, perhaps deserved. But HEB has this sort of special status in Texas, and people really love it. And it's a good grocery store, and it does a lot of charitable work. But, you know, what I got from just talking to just a couple of low-level employees was, I mean, you have a lot of the same behavior of any large retailer, right? Inconsistent part-time scheduling, sort of ways to get around providing benefits. Their $2 raise comes with an expiration date just like everyone else's. And so they're not like an entirely different breed. Let's just, you know, at least say that.
You also point out in your articles that there are legal protections for organizers here in Texas. So does that come from the state, or is that are those federal protections?
Federal, yeah. I think there's sort of a common idea in Texas that union organizing or unions are illegal or don't exist or something. That's sort of a common misconception. It's not true, of course. It is true that state employees are very limited in what they can do as far as striking. Like teachers, for instance, in Texas can pretty much be freely fired if they engage in a strike activity. But as far as the private sector goes, you're covered by the Federal National Labor Relations Act like anyone else, which in at least in theory means that, you know, you can't be retaliated against for union activities generally and in theory, you know, caveats. But
and Josh, you mentioned down there in McAllen, I guess he's relying on that.
Yeah.
Let's shift a little bit here from the supermarkets. You mentioned Amazon because of Whole Foods, but I think Amazon's warehouses have been the focus of a fair amount of attention recently. As I recall, they actually fired a couple of their organizers, if I recall correct.
Yeah, that's the reporting I've seen.
Yeah, but the interesting little coda to all this was last week that one of their top technology VPs from a different part of the business, from their cloud computing, cloud storage end of the business, Tim Bray,
yeah,
resigned as a result of that. I was a little bit heartened by that, and that it kept the matter in focus and that it wasn't so quickly forgotten.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, I don't know, I can't see the future or anything, but it seems to me that, you know, Amazon's reputation has kind of taken a hit during all of this, both with that story and the retaliation against workers. On the other hand, this kind of a massive disruption and a sort of isolation of people in their homes sort of plays right into the hands of a company like Amazon, right?
Their delivery trucks are everywhere.
Exactly. And it's a huge opening for them to make more inroads into the grocery industry, because already we've seen like a threefold increase or so, or maybe even more, in the amount of people using online delivery and pickup services. And the trade press publications that I've read predict that a decent amount of that will become permanent, which creates a disruption. And then so you've got the grocery chains are scrambling how to figure it out. There's Instacart in the mix. There's a lot of different players. But any type of big disruption like that and anything that involves logistics and delivery plays right into Amazon's hands, of course. So,
sure.
You know, there may be a lot of people angry at them, but they may come out just simply even more powerful on the other end of this.
Yeah. We could certainly cheer for the warehouse workers too, and hope that they come out even stronger, I guess.
Yeah.
Again, shifting just a little bit here, thinking about worker safety, you've also focused a little on the Denton State Supported Living Center. Could you talk a little about what's going on up there?
Yeah, basically, you know, I did a story that was kind of just trying to capture in general the way that the governor's sort of halting and uneven approach to this pandemic has affected the state's own employees.
Mm-hmm. All 328,000 of
them.
Yes,
exactly. It's a large group. And basically, the problem kind of falls in two buckets. One, for the state employees who really do need to report in person to work every day. For instance, those who work at state-supported living centers like the one in Denton, which are basically permanent campus living facilities for folks with different disabilities. And so there's really no way to do that job remotely, right? So the question there is simply a matter of precautions. And what you had there was a story that seemed to play out across a number of different agencies, was one, a certain degree of secrecy, as in a day before the first cases at that facility, and I'm really piggybacking on a lot of great reporting done by the Dallas Morning News and USA Today here, but a day before the first cases were confirmed, a supervisor sent out an email admonishing staff for spreading a rumor that someone had tested positive. And then so that really breaks down trust, you know, when you get an email one minute saying stop spreading this rumor, and then the next day they say, ah, never mind, we've got a case. And that the cases there really got out of control quite quickly. And from what I was able to learn, there is a state employees union staffer who also worked at that facility until very recently. From what I was able to learn from other workers and via him, a lot of it has to do with workers being shifted around from certain quarantine areas and then back to other areas of the campus. It has to do with insufficient PPE, which is a problem everywhere, of course. And I just wanted, one of the things I wanted to emphasize was, I think when people hear the term state employees, they might picture some type of bureaucrat at a desk or something, but a lot of state employees, including these workers, are making well under $30,000 a year. You know, these are not well-paid jobs, and they're hard jobs. And basically, there was a sort of halting, slow, inconsistent rollout of protections for workers who had to be in person. And the other bucket is basically workers that could work from home but aren't working from home. And so there I was able to talk to some eligibility workers who work with food stamps and Medicaid and the like. And basically their frustration that they're offices were kept open and they were forced to keep working in the offices all throughout March and well into April, partially because of technological issues, not being able to have the right kind of laptops provided to the employees and such, and just their frustration because a number of them were exposed. There's at least a couple offices where everyone got exposed to coronavirus and then had to go quarantine for 14 days, and a quicker response could have prevented that. So I mean, that's basically the gist. It's sort of a piece in my mind with the governor's general approach to this, which is to deflect authority down to local officials until the local officials do something he doesn't like, then take that authority away from them. And then finally, now, of course, we're entering this incredibly dangerous reopening phase.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. We're getting all sorts of inconsistent direction, it seems to me, from the state. Early on, it was all about deferring to local authorities.
Yeah, this was sort of what drew me to a story that I did on construction workers during all this. What sort of drew me to that angle was the early messaging from Governor Abbott was there should be no one-size-fits-all solution. What's right for one county is not right for another county. So we're not going to do a statewide shelter in place. Then later on, he finally comes around and issues what is basically a statewide shelter in place, but refuses to actually call it that, creating further confusion and so on and so forth. But in that order, after spending, you know, we're talking about sort of crucial, I believe, sort of crucial time for pandemic containment, after deferring to local authorities, suddenly, I don't know precisely who got in his ear or what, but certainly there was the building trades lobby was upset about construction restrictions that Austin and Travis County had put in place, which were basically going to limit construction during the pandemic to, you know, things like medical facilities or schools or something like that, but also affordable housing only. The only residential construction that they wanted was affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And the building lobby threw a fit about it. And sure enough, in very short order, the governor all of a sudden forgot his deference for local control and preempted it. So what I did, and this was, I guess it was over a month ago now, but what I did was just go out and take a look at the soccer stadium they're building in North Austin, which I know that there's a lot of money to be lost and there's contractual obligations and all that, but I don't think anyone would argue a soccer stadium is essential to combating COVID-19, right?
Right.
And I went and from a distance behind the fence at the construction site, I just stood there for a while and watched, you know, and I could just see construction workers were far closer to one another than 6 feet without masks. There was not social distancing going on. And from the construction workers I talked to, they just kind of frankly scoffed at the idea that you could ever really keep maintain social distancing on a construction site. So the thing that the workers I talked to were advocating for was to just actually limit it to essential construction, which is what Austin tried to do. And right. As is so common, the governor intervened.
And now we've got Paxton going after Austin and Travis County and Bayer County too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Dallas County's Judge Clay Jenkins is kind of emerging as a new, potentially competing with Austin for public enemy number one for the Republican leaders of the state right now. I mean, just thinking politically, I think in the early weeks of this pandemic, Jenkins kind of outshone them. He really emerged as sort of the most decisive and aggressive of the county executives and got a lot of good press for it. And I think that might have stuck in the craw of Abbott and Paxton and the rest, because now they seem to be coming after him.
Just amazing, you know.
Yeah, it all seems a little immature in a world historic moment such as this.
We're speaking with Gus Bova, staff writer for the Texas Observer. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on May 14th. Just before the break, we heard Queen doing Is This the World We Created? We're speaking with Gus Bova, staff writer for the Texas Observer. We've been discussing labor issues and homelessness. Let's continue. Do you want to comment on Alex Jones and the folks demonstrating at the Capitol at all?
That's so interesting. I had such a strong urge. I had such a strong urge to actually go and interview a bunch of those people, you know, like I really had the sort of reporter's urge to actually get out there, and because I can make my assumptions based on the videos, you know.
Right.
From the videos, it appeared to me that you had kind of a hardcore InfoWars aligned crowd who have shirts and signs with just wild slogans. They're far outside of the mainstream. And then maybe a coalition of sort of, I don't know, sort of maybe upper middle class Trump supporters who are very upset they can't get a haircut, or who maybe own businesses and are upset it's disrupting their livelihoods from that perspective. But that was just I could only really glean that from the videos. I really would have loved to be able to go and actually just interview a bunch of the random people there, honestly. I decided that wasn't worth the risk.
I was just reading about an NBC reporter in Columbus, Ohio, who did just what you were thinking about, you know, and she had her mask on. And just the fact that she was wearing a mask talking to this demonstrator, the guy got really aggressive with her.
Mm.
And, man, it was kind of tragic reading the whole thing. I don't have the details here, but she wound up just walking away from the person, you know?
There is something there, though. There is something that some people feel. I wonder what it is, that they see someone with a mask and they see it as the sort of suggestion that they should be wearing a mask, or I don't know, but something that provokes people sometimes. I don't know what it is exactly.
Yeah. There was one other interesting piece out of the Austin City Council. I don't know if you saw this, but they're talking about an Austin Civilian Conservation Corps program. And I don't know if that's just pie in the sky and still in the thinking stage, or if they're really serious about that. Have you been following that at all? Or
honestly, no. I'd love to hear about it if you want to talk about it, honestly.
Well, well, I don't have the details, but the reason why it drew my attention is that at least there's some hint of a program like that becoming sustainable. I admire the city for handing out cash, you know, going into its reserves and coming up with $15 million, especially for folks that aren't going to be or weren't getting that stimulus check from.
Exactly. You know, and I haven't had the chance to follow up in detail on exactly where that money's gone. But my understanding is that at least a chunk of it would end up in the hands of undocumented families.
Yeah, that's been whispered. You know, nobody talks about that too much, but
they don't want to make it explicit, I suppose. And fair enough. But that's such an unmet need. And it's frankly embarrassing.
Yeah,
it's embarrassing to this because when I was out looking at different construction sites around town, I mean, we all know you can ask anyone something on the order of half of construction workers in Texas are undocumented. And so if they're essential, so essential that they have to risk their health and the health of their families, and then we're going to turn around and say that you can't get unemployment insurance if you get sick or something like that, and you can't get this one-time piddly $1,200 stimulus check is just outrageous.
Yep. Well, I totally agree. And there's talk about more federal bailouts and, you know, God only knows where all that money's going, but I think it's going to disappear pretty quickly. And how long can you keep doing that? You know,
I mean, I've always been, I don't know. I don't want to play dumb, but it seems it would be more efficient to set up a monthly payment rather than go through this huge legislative fight that then trickles out $1,000 that I don't know about you, but I still haven't even gotten mine yet. I still haven't gotten my stimulus payment. It seems like if you really wanted to accomplish something, you would do the logistics work and then let the machine run on a monthly basis. But
yeah. And, you know, all these years we've been hearing about the infrastructure, the crumbling infrastructure of the United States, you know, and so we've got a huge need here. And now we've got, what, 20 some million people unemployed. And, you know, I think some really creative thinking is called for here, you know. Enough on that. Let's switch over to you've been covering homeless issues lately. And right now, I think the current figure is that it's estimated that there are about 25,000 homeless in Texas.
Yes.
I know in January, Echo was the administrator for that point in time count. I have not heard any figures on that. We actually had the ED from Echo on the show soon after that, but they weren't in any position to talk about those figures. About half of those folks are in shelters, and about half of them are basically out in the streets. I mean, that's the rough take on it all. And I think, you know, we're talking about COVID-19 here and everything. And I don't think irony is quite the right word here, but the tragedy is that the message is wash your hands frequently. Then you look at homeless people, you know, and you just got to ask, so where are they going to do that?
Yes. Or of course, the most absurd advice, stay home, right? Absolutely. I mean, the sort of standard advice isn't written with the unhoused in mind. And again, it's sort of a two bucket problem. The shelters are incredibly poorly equipped to comply with social distancing mandates, right? And that's not some profound insight. Literally by design, they're meant to fit roughly as many people as possible with some degree of dignity and, you know, perhaps fire code and all that. But basically, there are never enough shelter beds pretty much anywhere in the nation. So the goal is to fit as many as you can. And then all of a sudden, you're told to keep people 6 feet apart from one another. Sure. And this was, I think it was back in March when I was doing these interviews, but I talked to shelter directors in Austin, El Paso, Dallas, Houston. And basically, I mean, people were doing what they could, but no one even tried to pretend that they could 100% comply with the recommended protocols inside of a homeless shelter, right?
Yeah.
And so there's that. Both the Salvation Army and the Arch downtown have had cases. I don't have an updated number, but I can say they both had at least one.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the problem of the unsheltered homeless, which are basically the group that has been the source of the target of so much controversy in Austin over the last year or so.
Yeah.
And there, at least if you look at an encampment under a highway or something, you can see how it would be easier to get 6 feet apart than it would in a shelter. But then you've got to think about hygiene. You've got to think about what you need to do on a daily basis to get your food and basic needs met. And you've got to think about something I noticed is just a lack of access to information. Because if I feel like I'm on a day-to-day basis kind of sometimes losing the thread on what's going on with this worldwide pandemic. So, you know, imagine someone with much less access to information. I don't know how often you've been out driving around the city. What I've seen driving around is that the camps, because when the pandemic struck, the state and the city stopped doing these sort of, sometimes people call them sweeps, sometimes people call them cleanups of the homeless encampments. So they stopped doing those. And so what I've observed is that the encampments have grown. You know, there's more tents. People have been able to stay stable in a location for longer. And the city has distributed hand washing stations and porta potties.
Hmm.
Which that hand washing stations and porta potties, I've always kind of wondered why, until you're ready to actually house all these people, I've always wondered why the city didn't consider just making that a permanent fixture at certain encampment locations.
Under 183, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you, at some point, you're just, this was all covered and explained in depth when Austin was having its policy fight last summer, but at a certain point, you're just shuffling around a problem. You're not solving it at all. It's kind of burying your head in the sand to just force people to leave an encampment and then you drive away and act like they're not going to just slowly trickle back over the next week. So, I mean, it seems smarter to me to find the locations that make sense and provide some hygiene equipment. I also have, just before we started the interview, I don't know if I'm breaking this news right now or if someone else has reported it, but there have been at least 3 positive tests at the governor's camp out off Montopolis, out off 183, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, there have been 3 cases. I just talked to a state spokesperson an hour ago, and there have been 3 cases, and they just did another round of testing yesterday, and so the spokesperson predicted that there will be more positive tests coming. So the city has relocated some of the more people with pre-existing conditions, and of people of a certain age, they relocated them from that camp to hotel rooms. There are 3 cases, and we could be looking at a real spread out there. That might be I'm not sure. I need to check. I might be breaking that news for you right now. You might be breaking news on this show today.
Okay. Well, the 3 cases are confirmed, you say, huh?
Yeah, I mean, that came straight from the state, so.
Okay.
Say, I mean, just as a reminder, there's 180 or so people out on that 5 or 7 acre lot out there right now, so. Yeah.
And we are recording this on May 14th, just to I'll remind folks. It looks like they're not out busting up camps under the interstates and so forth. Austin, the city of Austin, was pursuing purchase of some hotel property, motel properties, I think, down on South I-35. Is that all on hold at the moment, do you know?
Well, I just talked to someone who was relocated from the governor's camp to, I believe, the same hotel that the city's long-term looking at buying. But I'll be honest, I am not sure where the city is at in the actual finalizing the purchase.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your articles on the homeless. Did you have anything else you wanted to add on that topic?
One story that I sort of made an exception for and did leave the house and go meet someone in person was someone had submitted a story through our Observer tip line, actually, and her name's Rachel, and she was describing basically a sort of nightmarish ordeal of being in the Travis County jail as COVID-19 was really taking off and spreading. Travis County agreeing to release her, but then because of some stuff from her past, all non-violent stuff, not serious stuff, but she was then transferred to the Bexar County Jail. So at the height of a pandemic, she was transferred from one jail to another jail. The Bexar County Jail has had a lot of positive cases. She is able to get out of that, but there's no plan. There's no plan for her at all. She had been intermittently homeless before she was incarcerated. And basically, Bexar County just turned her out to the streets late at night in the midst of a pandemic to find her own way. And so I was able to meet up with her in North Austin and just kind of talk about how there's no bridge right now. There's this rush, and there should be this rush, to get people out of jails, which are proving to be just, you know, horrific hotspots for COVID-19. But there's no follow-up for people who have nowhere to go. And it's not a small percentage of people in local jails who don't have a reliable address.
We had Amanda Woog on here a few weeks ago talking about the whole bail reform issue and Abbott's executive order,
yeah, you know,
against the local judicial discretion. And then Texas Supreme Court ruled on that. It just seemed to make the whole thing even less clear. So I don't know, but
just in general, it feels sort of, it doesn't feel right that we have, when we basically should all be sort of, as a society, laser focused on minimizing deaths from the worst pandemic in 100 years, that our state is actually caught up in these sort of pre-existing political battles over abortion and fairly moderate bail reforms.
Yeah, exactly. It also just seems to me that, try to imagine yourself as the sheriff of a county faced with the prospect of this pandemic racing through your jail. Even if you forget about the moral concerns or anything, just think about the financial concerns about running all these people to hospitals and whatnot. Surely the sheriffs, you know, it's in their best interest to try to reduce their populations as much as possible. And you'd think they'd get some support from the state for doing this.
Yeah.
So just to wrap up a couple of miscellaneous things going on here. So it sounds like there's all sorts of stuff being done in Washington these days, you know, in the environment and, you know, the border. We've got the wall. It seems to be accelerating at this point. Yeah. Is that your perception?
Yeah, I think that's just, no pun intended, but that's the concrete reality. Mm-hmm. Basically, in the Southwest, where we're talking Arizona, New Mexico, where it's much easier to build the wall because the government already owns the land along the border, construction has been proceeding quite quickly using the funds that siphoned off from the Department of Defense.
Right.
Construction's been proceeding quite quickly. I don't really make it out that far very often, but from people I follow online, I've seen, you know, these massive ancient stands of saguaro cacti torn to the ground. People are very concerned about certain species, including the jaguar, actually, in southern Arizona. In Texas, as always, it goes more slowly because the border is essentially entirely privately owned. But it is accelerating. It is objectively accelerating. I sort of keep a running list of federal lawsuits against landowners in South Texas. And there's been more than 30 since December, which is a definite ramp up from the last few years. They have broken ground on some new wall construction in Hidalgo County. They are working on getting into Starr County next door. And then the big, in my mind, a big controversial bit of news is that they just awarded a first contract for Webb County, which is where Laredo is. And, you know, Laredo is sort of the the major Texas border city that is right on the river that does not have any wall currently, if that makes sense. It's sort of a really high profile, controversial target for this wall, and the city has been intensely fighting it. I'll have a story in the next issue of our magazine about it. There's been very consistent, spirited opposition from local leaders. And the contract is for 14 miles, and it's with construction set to start January 2021. So if you want to talk about potential stakes of the presidential election, there's one right there.
I believe that is the busiest international border for the U.S., if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. It's the busiest port, land or sea, in the country.
Yeah. Well, finally, I noticed you had a review of a film called The Pushback. Do you want to talk about that for just a minute or two?
Yeah. You know, we had all of this, all these film reviews, all this film coverage planned for South by Southwest, right? And then, of course, that got canceled. This was one of the movies that was supposed to premiere then. And with this one, just because of the subject matter, we decided to go ahead and run the review anyways. The movie will get released at some point. They're basically still trying to figure out how to do some type of online release or something this summer. But we decided to run with it anyways because it just touched on so much of what we and I have covered over the last few years. I put in the piece that it was really a shame because I feel like South by Southwest is sort of dominated by this kind of Silicon Valley techno optimism. And this movie's really about people in Texas trying to make the state a fairer and more just place. It's got the Austin City Council member Natasha Harper Madison is a main character. Veronica Escobar out in El Paso is a main character. A lot of the landowners fighting the border wall that I've interviewed appear in the movie. I'm in the movie at one point, so that's enough reason to see it right there, right? And it's good. It's got Richard Linklater production. I mean, I recommend watching it. I mean, I didn't solely gush over it. There's a couple of criticisms in the review, but overall, I think, I wish it would. I'm eager for it to come out because I think it's kind of a hopeful film for these times.
Well, and we could certainly use some of that, couldn't we?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think we're about out of time here. I really thank you for joining us today. Again, we recorded this on May 14th. It's always good to talk to you, Gus, and hope to get you back here again soon and find out what you're writing about then, okay?
Yeah, thanks for having me, and stay safe.
Okay, thanks a lot. A quick note from the Community Council at Co-op. We want to know how you're faring through the COVID-19 crisis. If you have questions about community resources, or if you'd just like to share a story about people doing good work, you can leave us a message by emailing covid19@coop.org, or you can call or text 512-710-5353. A member of our community council will get back to you. That's covid19@coop.org. COVID19@koop.org, or 512-710-5353 for Co-op's COVID-19 Community Response Line. Well, that's all for this evening. Please join us next week when our guests will be David Baker and Patrick Cox, who are taking on the Kinder Morgan Pipeline. Stay tuned for Root Strain with Dale Smith coming up next. Have a good evening, everyone, and stay safe.